Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Shocking revelations. The Trump Justice Department seized phone records from its enemies in Congress.
It's just another terrible abuse of the rule of law. It's also such a body blow to our democracy.
Plus, President Biden on the world stage. He says America has turned a page.
We're committed to leading with strength. The United States is back.
It's fantastic. It's a breath of fresh air.
And new hope for a bipartisan deal on infrastructure. But some Democrats say Biden should go it alone.
It is time to move forward. The Republicans have held us up long enough.
Inside Politics, the biggest stories sourced by the best reporters now.
Welcome to Inside Politics Sunday. I'm Abby Phillip. The days of Donald Trump's America First foreign policy are over. That is the message President Joe Biden wants the world to hear as he travels through Europe on his first foreign trip as president. One example, he's announcing that the U.S. will buy and donate 500 million doses of Pfizer's COVID vaccine.
America will be the arsenal of vaccines in our fight against global COVID-19. Just as America was the arsenal of democracy during World War II, our vaccine donations don't include pressure for favors or potential concessions. We're doing this to save lives, to end this pandemic. That's it, period.
After 4 years of Trump-triggered drama at every international summit, you can almost hear the audible sigh of relief from Biden's fellow world leaders.
There's so much that they want to do together with us. It's fantastic. It's a breath of fresh air.
He stands for the commitment to multilateralism, which we were missing in recent years.
I think it's great to have the U.S. president part of the club and very willing to cooperate.
And we'll hear from President Biden in about an hour. He's set to hold a news conference as the G7 summit concludes this morning. Joining me now with their reporting and their insights, Olivier Knox of The Washington Post, Vivian Salama of The Wall Street Journal, CNN's John Harwood, and Politico's Laura Barron Lopez. Thanks for all for being here today. And as the kids say, they love to see it. Apparently, they are very happy to see Biden across the pond. John, this message of America is back, how is it resonating overseas?
Very well. And it's one of the realities of this situation is that Joe Biden went to this overseas trip with a huge asset, and that is that Donald Trump is a very easy act to follow. He acts buffoonishly on the world stage. He is somebody who openly aligned himself with American adversaries, with Russia. He went out of his way to poke fingers in the eye of other G7 leaders. And so it's natural that they welcome a U.S. president who wants to work with them and solve common problems. Climate, for example, the coronavirus pandemic, economic recovery. That doesn't mean there aren't differences because multilateralism is difficult. You've got to work with other countries. So they had disagreement, for example, on China, how aggressive to be in confronting China. Joe Biden has this theme of democracy standing up and showing they can work in competition with autocracies. But that is that common effort is something that other world leaders welcome. And Joe Biden, just like the first president I covered, George H.W. Bush, is somebody very comfortable on the world stage, knows a lot of these leaders. He was back in his element.
And speaking of comfort, I mean, physically, it was a very different scene overseas. I mean, lots of touching and back patting and not so much finger pointing as we've seen in previous summits with the previous president. There is a body language shift that also reflects a shift in public opinion. in what we've seen, according to this a recent Pew poll, that in Europe and in Canada and in Germany and among the G7 countries, you've got the general population going from, you know, 30-point swings in their, you know, favorable view of the United States, their favorable view of the ability of an American president to operate. This is a lot of goodwill. Olivier, do you think that it will have actual dividends for the United States?
It's a great question. And if you dig a little bit further into that Pew poll, you find that actually a small minority of respondents say that the United States is a very reliable ally. We can't paper over the unease still in Europe. They're watching our politics. They saw January 6th. They know that Donald Trump doesn't accept the results of the election. And they know that there is a menagerie of governors and senators who are willing to take up the Trump mantle. So all of this America is back strikes me a little bit as fortune cookie foreign policy. They know. They're watching this stuff. Yeah. They know the big lesson of the Trump era. They saw swings before HW to Clinton, Clinton to W to Obama. They've seen changes in foreign policy, but nothing like the last 4 years. And now they quite reasonably think, well, this could happen again.
There's some anxiety about the potential of this not being durable. Vivian, just a couple of years ago, both Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, and France's President Emmanuel Macron had some really tough words for Europe about what the future of the U.S.-European relationship ought to be. They were saying that the era in which we could fully rely on the United States is over to some extent. That was Merkel in 2017. And Macron says Europe can no longer rely on the United States for its security. So do you get the sense that that has shifted, or is it just on hold for now?
Well, they're certainly breathing a sigh of relief, as you said, but also a lot of questions about what our future politics holds here in the United States. There's this looming question about, does Donald Trump come back to become president, or is the Republican Party sort of shifting in his favor? And is that sort of the more favorable view of everybody kind of goes it alone? And so no one really knows how to proceed. And the Europeans, while they certainly are embracing Biden, who has arrived and talks the talk of multilateralism and working together, they're also very apprehensive about what they've seen in America in the last couple of months and years. And so they want to also address their own issues. I mean, keep in mind that they also have their constituents to answer to. And so Angela Merkel, and who is on her way out, by the way, but Francis Macron especially, he has economic interests in, you know, sort of working with China at the same time that the Biden administration talks about cracking down with China. And so they themselves are also interested in their own domestic issues. And so it kind of leaves us wondering where we're going to be in the next couple of years when Biden is back and saying, let's work together. And they're like, well, let's see about that.
Yeah, I mean, the China issue is the issue mm-hmm. that they have been stuck on. We're still waiting for this G7 communique to come out, perhaps sometime this morning. And the question is, how tough will they be on China? You have several European countries that are okay with maybe becoming more financially entangled with China, getting Chinese investment. And Biden saying, this is a question of democracy versus autocracy. How is that going to play out?
Yeah, and a few years ago, China wasn't even mentioned in the communique. So the big question is, how far do they go in confronting China in that statement? Do they say, do they confront them on the forced labor of the Uyghur in Xinjiang? Do they also say that they want to move towards that different investments, what the administration is calling higher quality infrastructure investments, and having a higher standard on labor and on climate standards, rather, and providing those to lower and middle income countries, as opposed to going the route of China with their roads loan program, which a lot of countries are turning to. And so that's what the administration has been really focused on during this summit. And it's also a big piece of his domestic agenda. Biden overall is arguing that that his agenda, if it doesn't pass, and that if what he's trying to push at the G7 doesn't happen, that the U.S. will not be as competitive against China, and that China will continue to grow in emergence and outcompete the country. And so that's one of his central pillars of his agenda.
There has been, between the vaccine announcement, John, and also this announcement about a sort of global infrastructure investment that is designed really to be a counter to China. Those two things are great. Nice on the world stage. We're giving them away, no strings attached. But do you get the sense that this is really what it's going to take to put China in a box if that's what the Biden administration wants to do.
It's part of what it takes. I mean, we all know money talks. And through this Belt and Road Initiative, China has been laying a lot of money down, especially to underdeveloped countries, to try to use dollar diplomacy, get them on their side. The United States can compete, and other democracies have tried to compete on the basis of values, but dollar diplomacy also is relevant for democracies as well. I mean, we've seen that all the way back to John F. Kennedy's administration, the Peace Corps, foreign aid, the Marshall Plan after World War II. So there are ways in which the United States and other democracies, after periods in which they've turned inward, and people have said, you know, Donald Trump championed in America first and said everyone else is taking advantage of us. And so he was trying to grab what he could for the United States. But if you take a larger view of what the United States' obligations and challenges are on the world stage, you realize you've got to lay down some money and assistance yourself. And that's what Biden's doing.
Yeah. And there's more to come, not just on that issue of China, but also on the issue of Russia. Coming up next, Biden's biggest international test is still to come, his meeting with Vladimir Putin. The main event of President Biden's first foreign trip is still ahead, Wednesday's summit with Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Sizing up Putin has always been an important test for the U.S. commander-in-chief.
When I looked the man in the eye, I was able to get a sense of his soul. He's a man deeply committed to his country.
What is true is that the Russians intended to meddle, and they meddled. Vladimir Putin's not on our team.
I like Putin. He likes me. You know, we get along. It's better. Isn't it? Wouldn't you say it's smart to get along? Okay? Smart.
On this trip, Biden telegraphed his relationship with Russia is going to be very different from former President Donald Trump's.
But I've been clear. The United States will respond in a robust and meaningful way when the Russian government engages in harmful activities.
The specter of the former president is hanging over this meeting, of course, with Putin. And, you know, Vivian, how do you think that that is going to play out? Especially since it seems like Putin is already setting this up as a Biden versus Trump kind of situation. Actually, take a listen to what he told NBC just this past week.
I believe that former U.S. President Mr. Trump is an extraordinary individual, talented individual. He's a colorful individual. You may like him or not. President Biden is a career man. He has spent virtually his entire adulthood in politics. There are some advantages, some disadvantages, but there will not be any impulse-based movements on behalf of the sitting U.S. president.
I would hazard to guess that the lack of impulse movements is exactly what the White House is hoping for.
Definitely hoping for. And remember, you know, while President Biden is definitely a different personality, he has a history of gaffes in situations like this. And so they're definitely hoping that they can avoid that because of the fact that President Putin is someone who is very unpredictable and can really throw things out of left field. And so a lot of what President Putin is saying right now is reality, that he sees a different adversary in the United States president right now. And a lot of it is also shtick, where he says, you know, he goes out there and he says, you know, Trump was basically someone who worked with me and we got along, even though his administration actually did crack down on Russia quite a bit in the last couple of years. President Trump's messaging was very different, but that's not actually in reality what the relationship was like. And he had said that the relationship was in a bad place. And so we're going to go and we're going to basically see that if President Biden is able to get some deliverables out of this meeting, a very tough adversary, a very shrewd negotiator in Putin. He tends to throw things, again, out of left field during these meetings. I mean, you know, the famous story, which is an example of kind of how he tries to catch his adversaries off guard. In 2007, when he met with Angela Merkel, he rocked up with a big Labrador, his dog, Coney. And Angela Merkel is known to be terrified of dogs. And the dog sat there staring at her the entire time. And so things like that.
He's like a professional troller.
He's a professional troller.
But I mean, that's one of the reasons why the White House is already signaling, according to our reporting at CNN, that they're unlikely to have one of those joint press conferences at the end. They are not trying to give him an opportunity to do that kind of thing. So who gets the most out of this meeting in general, Olivier?
Well, I think we need to let the meeting happen before we reach that conclusion. I think the way that both the Kremlin and the White House have been building this up over the past week has been interesting. Both sides raising the stakes again and again for a meeting that we don't expect to deliver a lot of breakthroughs. Yeah. But you saw, you know, you quoted Biden's comments. Of course, in the run-up to this, he agreed that Putin was a killer. In the past, he said Putin doesn't have a soul. So we know pretty much where Joe Biden's coming at from this. But this is a moment for Joe Biden to do a better job, I'll say, than what Barack Obama did in 2016. This is sort of the cut-it-out meeting, right? In 2016, Barack Obama sits down, tells Putin, I know you're interfering in our elections, cut it out. We know how that played out, right? This time around, it's SolarWinds hack, it's ransomware, it's all the other aspects of Russia's cyber attacks, right. Cyber offenses.
And not just the cyber offenses. I mean, the long list of provocative actions from Moscow, I mean, it's extraordinary. Election interference, cyber attacks, as you mentioned, sending troops to the Ukraine border, the jailing of a dissident, Navalny, and the banning of the opposition group. That happened just this past week. Reports that Russia is preparing to supply Iran with advanced satellite systems. There's a lot that Putin has been able to do in just about 4 years. Can the genie be put back in the bottle?
Well, we don't know what effect a different tone from Biden is going to have, but the different tone is the point of the meeting. It's not about breakthroughs. This is about a transition from an American president who was openly sympathetic to Vladimir Putin. Let's just step back and remember, Vladimir Putin helped Donald Trump get elected, and he did it for a reason. Donald Trump then became president, covered for Putin when he was challenged, isn't Putin a killer? He said, oh, you think we're so innocent in the United States? When he was asked about Putin going after opponents physically, Trump would say, like, oh, maybe not. We don't really know. He questioned the U.S. commitment to Article 5 under NATO. He poked the eyes of Western allies, so he divided the alliance in multiple ways. He tried to get Putin and Russia back into the G7. So in multiple ways, he did Vladimir Putin's bidding. Joe Biden is going to Geneva to say that's not happening anymore. Now, that's a different question from whether what Joe Biden is doing is going to get Vladimir Putin to stop cyberware, ransomware attacks
from
happening.
There is a need for actual, I mean, the tone is one thing, but there's a need for either actual cooperation or a change in behavior.
On climate and on some other issues.
That's correct.
On Putin's part, right?
For sure.
It's not just about the rhetoric.
There are. I mean, the deliverables are important, but again, no one here is expecting major deliverables from this meeting, given that it's the first one. So, I mean, the ransomware is something that Biden is facing a lot of pressure on, especially from lawmakers in the run-up to this meeting. From both parties, they're saying you need to confront Putin on this because of we've seen the attacks on the gasoline pipeline as well as the meatpacking company. And so that's a big thing on the administration's agenda heading into the meeting.
That's coming up on Wednesday. Later today, on a lighter note, Biden will meet with Queen Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. This is her 13th meeting with a U.S. president, but not Biden's first meeting with her, actually, which maybe is, I don't know if it's a tribute to his longevity or hers, but
both.
or both. But that's one of the other things that we are looking forward to today. But coming up next, a top Democrat says former President Trump weaponized the Justice Department to find so-called leakers. The Justice Department's internal watchdog is launching a new investigation into potential Trump-era abuses of power. The issue, a push by the Trump Justice Department to secretly seize phone and email data from the former president's political enemies and their families, including sitting members of Congress.
Going after a committee that was investigating him, you know, one guardrail after another just smashed by this unethical former president.
Absolutely, he weaponized the Justice Department.
The subpoenas were part of a long-running investigation into leaks about the Trump-Russia probe, and former Attorney General Bill Barr claimed in an interview with Politico this week that neither he nor Trump were ever briefed on the subpoenas. And his deputy, Rod Rosenstein, former and his predecessor, Jeff Sessions, said that he knew nothing about it either. CNN's legal national security and analyst Carrie Cordero joins us at the table, as well as Politico's Melanie Zanona. Now, Carrie, you've got Barr denying it, Rosenstein denying it, Sessions denying it. But take a listen to this exchange between Bill Barr and Kamala Harris a couple years ago on this very general topic.
Has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone? Yes or no, please, sir.
The president or anybody else.
Seems you would remember something like that and be able to tell us.
Yeah, but I'm trying to grapple with the word suggest. I mean, there have been discussions of matters out there that they have not asked me to open an investigation.
There have been discussions of matters out there. They have not asked me. But is it plausible that he would not have known, especially on the issue of metadata from members of Congress being caught up as part of an investigation?
So in this case, although he was very clearly parsing his words there, and there were certainly some kind of conversations that perhaps had gone on, it is plausible that he didn't, that Attorney General Barr didn't know about these specific subpoenas, just simply based on the timing of when he was Attorney General and when the reports are of when these subpoenas are issued. So according to the Wall Street Journal, for example, the subpoenas were in early 2018. Bill Barr wasn't Attorney General until 2019. So now, could any Attorney General during this entire period not have known? Again, under normal Justice Department process, in a sensitive national security case like this, one would think that the Attorney General, whoever he was, would have been briefed. The only reason I think it's possibly plausible that none of the attorney generals knew in this circumstance is because the Trump administration created such chaos in the Justice Department. So they forced out Attorney General Sessions. Then there was a new attorney general. There were multiple acting and then finally a Senate confirmed assistant attorney general for national security. So there was a lot of turmoil in the management of the department.
Terry, is it possible that, let's say, attorney generals didn't know, okay? Is it conceivable that career officials would take these steps without notifying any high-ranking political appointee? Set aside Rosenstein, set aside Sessions and Barr. Is that conceivable that career officials would do this themselves on their own?
So it's not the way that it should work in a sensitive national security investigation. I mean, sending subpoenas on information for members of the intelligence committee, is something that, in my judgment and according to Justice Department policy, should be briefed to the highest levels, including the head of the National Security Division, and I would argue the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General.
There is this question of whether Trump knew or whether it even matters that he ordered it or didn't order it. I mean, he had been attacking both Adam Schiff and others on the committee publicly and openly for months. Take a listen.
Comey is a leaker and he's a liar. And not only on this stuff, he's been leaking for years.
Whether it was Shifty Schiff or somebody else, they leak the information before it gets in. You have leakers on the committee, leakers that are doing bad things.
It's extraordinary also the settings in which he would attack people for leaking. It could be a FEMA briefing, but he'll still attack Adam Schiff. So, I mean, at the same time, does it matter, do you think, whether Trump knew or ordered any of this to happen?
I mean, I think, of course, it matters. Finding out just how far up the chain this went, of course, it matters. There are questions of separation of powers here that are very important. It is not unprecedented for administrations to go after members of Congress, but this is unusual. This should not be routine. I'll put it that way.
And I was going to say, Democrats are going to want to get to the bottom of this. Right. They're going to want to haul Jeff Sessions and Bill Barr up to Capitol Hill and hear from them under oath. You know, Bill Barr spoke to one of my colleagues at Politico and tried to distance himself and said he had no knowledge of this. But Democrats want that under oath. The problem is, I don't know whether they would actually come testify, if they would fight a subpoena. Right. And so I really think what we're going to see on Capitol Hill is a push for reforms at the DOJ. And Democrats are starting to realize that just because there's been a shift in political power doesn't erase what they view has been the erosion of the institution. And so I think you are going to see a broader push here for the guardrails to be put back.
Yeah, and there is, to your point, a real possibility of defying of subpoenas, which was a hallmark of the Trump administration. And many of these officials have a complete disregard for Congress. But you have some Democratic lawmakers, including Congressman Ted Lieu, putting the pressure on the Biden administration and saying, you guys need to do better. He says, directing this at the Justice Department, that this shouldn't be how the Garland DOJ works. Your job is not to maximize presidential power. Do better. He's saying we should not have found out about this through press reports because these gag orders have expired. So the Biden administration's in a tough spot because he put Merrick Garland at DOJ to stay out of some of this political stuff, right?
They are in a tough spot because Joe Biden wants to move ahead. He doesn't want to look behind. And he's trying to unite the country. And the further you go into delving into investigations of what Trump did, the more difficult it is to do that. Nevertheless, there are some things that can't be avoided. And to your point about the Trump administration defying subpoenas, we just last week got the testimony of Don McGahn, which had been sought for a couple of years. And Don McGahn testified to the way in which Donald Trump had corrupted the processes of government, that Donald Trump asked him to fire Bob Mueller. Donald Trump also asked him later to lie about that and say that he had not done it. So the incident with Swalwell and with Schiff has to be viewed in that context of a president who regarded the apparatus of government as his own personal property to be used for his own personal benefit.
But to what extent is that, unique? Or what are the parallels? I mean, some people have brought up Nixon, but do you think that those are valid?
Well, here's what I think is the red flag in these particular subpoenas. It's the scope of them. It's the fact that, according to reports, there were 73 phone numbers, 36 email accounts, and that's just for one provider. Normally, in this type of circumstance, if you are conducting an investigation and serving one provider, in this case, Apple, most likely there are subpoenas that went to other providers, so for other email accounts or phone numbers. So it's the scope of it, the number of individuals on the committee or associated with the committee who were dragged into this. That's what, to me, as a former national security lawyer, indicates that this was not managed well, right, not in Justice Department policy, not in control.
And perhaps a fishing expedition. For
just overly broad. If you're dealing with something with a congressional committee, that's when it should be narrow, focused, targeted.
Exactly. Well, coming up next, there is a bipartisan breakthrough on infrastructure, potentially, but why are so many Democrats saying this is too little, too late? A group of 10 moderate senators, five from each party, say they've reached a deal on a bipartisan infrastructure plan. It adds up to $1.2 trillion, but about half of that in new money that wasn't already going to be spent. And it's all for core infrastructure. Think roads and bridges. It'd be paid for in part by raising the gas tax, but that is a long way from what many Democrats and the Biden administration initially wanted. So the question for Congress this week is, are there votes for something that looks like this? $1.2 trillion, but a lot of it excluding some of the top priorities that Democrats had had.
Yeah, and also look at what the pay-fors are. It's unused COVID relief money. It's indexing the gas tax to inflation. Those are both non-starters with the White House. You have progressives who say this isn't big and bold enough. And I don't think this has buy-in yet from the rest of the parties or the White House. So, yes, they achieved what has not been done yet on Capitol Hill, which is putting pen to paper on a bipartisan infrastructure plan. But that's really only half the battle. And so we still have a long way to go. Time is running out. It's already June. Congress has a whole week off in July. They have all of August off. So, you know, I just don't see whether this is really going to move the needle in the next couple of weeks
here. The return of Washington summers where everybody leaves town. But over at the White House, they put out a very tepid reaction to this bipartisan plan. I mean, frankly, they've been seeking a bipartisan deal, but they don't seem to be thrilled by this one. What's your sense of how likely they are to either play ball with this and maybe continue to tweak it, or maybe reject it out of hand because it just doesn't do what they want it to do?
I don't think they're going to reject it out of hand. I think they're going to play ball with it at least for a little while. There are options that they think can be substituted for the pay-fors that Melanie was just detailing, things like enhanced IRS enforcement. Is that something Republicans could buy into? The user fees that Mitt Romney talks about, are there corporate-only user fees? And could they deficit finance some of it? It's very difficult to do, but the White House can't afford to rule it out of hand for a couple of reasons. One, they have to go through this process to keep the Democratic caucus united for whatever comes next. And they also, you know, let's say they rejected this plan and rolled everything into one big infrastructure bill. Very large price tag on this bill. So one of the advantages of a bipartisan deal, if you can get one, if there's one that's reasonable within shouting distance of what you want, is that it carves down the price tag of what you later do through reconciliation. They're going to do reconciliation in any case, right? This is not going to be the end of the story. But the question is, how do you get to the end of the story?
You get a lot of Democrats already crying foul over this deal and kind of saying, we're done with all of this talking. Democrats from a wide range of sort of the political spectrum within the party.
Creating space for bipartisan talks is always welcome, but we should act sooner than later.
We can't have an infrastructure bill in 2021 that doesn't have climate at its center. No climate, no deal.
No voter that I've talked to in Georgia said to me, what's most important is that we get a bipartisan deal.
But of course, the two Democrats who are among the most important are Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. If this bipartisan deal doesn't work out, you heard John talking about the reconciliation process that would allow them to move forward with just 50 votes without getting rid of the filibuster. That's still available to them. Do you get the sense that Sinema and Manchin would be willing to do that if this bipartisan deal falls through?
Not yet, which is what they keep saying. Them, as well as others like Senator Gene Shaheen, have said, we don't think the votes are there just yet if we go it alone through the reconciliation. And so that's why the White House doesn't see a rush to move fully on to reconciliation. They want the key senators, they want Majority Leader Schumer, Senator Bernie Sanders, to get the ball rolling on crafting what needs to be started, that process for reconciliation. But they also have reason to let these bipartisan talks keep going because they know that they need Manchin and Sinema to come along.
I also have some questions about whether, let's say they get a small deal now in a bipartisan fashion. Melanie, do you think it's realistic that there could be a second bite at this apple on infrastructure, reconciliation or not?
That is a great question, right? I mean, I think there are two storylines to watch here. A lot of ink has been spilled on Manchin and Sinema and the centrist Democrats. But don't forget, with such slim majorities in the House, progressives could run the show, too, if they really wanted to and if they did vote no. Now, whether they'd be willing to play hardball, I'm not quite sure yet. You know, they flexed their muscles a little bit on a capital aid security package a few weeks ago. But I think Biden and Democratic leaders need to make sure they're tending to all their gardens and not just the centrists.
Yeah. So, Olivia, I want to get your thoughts on this, because the overarching question facing Biden is how important really is bipartisanship? You heard Raphael Warnock saying, nobody I go home to says we must have a bipartisan deal or nothing at all. And Perry Bacon in The Washington Post writes that there just aren't that many swing voters. He said there is virtually no evidence that a block of voters who would otherwise back Republican congressional candidates next year will instead support Democrats if they perceive Biden as really trying hard to be bipartisan. That's probably not the view within the White House right now, or is it?
Well, I think that I'm really glad Melanie brought up the growing impatience from the progressives, because it really is, to me, one of the big storylines of this past week. It's really, really important. You can hear them get very testy about the absence of climate stuff in this infrastructure. You're hearing them getting really testy about voting rights, which is why the Justice Department made all those announcements, beefing up their teams and taking steps to safeguard voting rights. And to Perry's
Israel,
point,
Ilhan Omar,
absolutely.
I mean, the divisions are really starting to.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because I think that's super important over this past week. I also think that in the White House, they don't believe that there are that many voters in 2022 who will look back at 2021 and say, well, we didn't get an infrastructure bill, but we tried to be bipartisan.
Right, right.
Don't think anyone's going to vote based on that outside the United States Senate.
Right. They believe that it's about the result that matters.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily about the process. And I think we all know at this table that no one cares about the process except maybe us. So up next, how Vice President Harris is tackling her sprawling and complicated new portfolio. Vice President Kamala Harris has been given a to-do list loaded with all but impossible tasks. Immigration tops that list and was the focus of her first foreign trip. But she drew criticism for telling migrants, do not come to the U.S. border, and for not yet visiting the actual U.S.-Mexico border.
You haven't been to the border.
I haven't been to Europe. And I don't understand the point that you're making.
I've said I'm going to go to the border. And
when are you going to the border, Vice President?
The administration has asked. I'm not finished. I've said I'm going to the border.
It's just a little cringeworthy. And I know that her allies in the White House and elsewhere are watching it and just kind of wondering what is going on. How poorly did this go for her, her first foray onto the world stage?
Well, it certainly didn't go the way the White House wanted it to go. And again, immigration, as you mentioned, Heavy, is a hot potato no one wants to touch. And Harris has been dealt it. And so she has to handle now what Biden had to handle when he was VP, which is relationships with the Northern Triangle. And of course, Republicans have been trying to clump that in with the border and the border situation and attacking her on that. Now, did the trip go the way they wanted? No. In 2024, 2028, whenever, if she decides to run, are people going to remember this trip? I don't really think so.
Yeah, that's definitely true. This is one event. Maybe it's the first, but it's one. But there are some broader questions about, is this part of a pattern? I mean, even in the campaign, she struggled with press interviews, had some major flip-flops on the campaign trail. I mean, is this part of a pattern for her? And should it be troubling to her advisors and allies and people who want her to succeed that it's still happening even as vice president?
I mean, to be clear, she was going to be asked this question, and the fact that they didn't have something better than I haven't been to Europe is fairly notable.
Yeah.
Republicans have been pounding away at this issue for weeks and for months. You can argue that physically going to the border serves no meaningful policy purpose, except, okay, I saw the border, I saw what conditions are like there. But the fact that they didn't have a response, that they didn't anticipate this is, it's malpractice.
Can we also just point out, so Republicans have been hammering Kamala over this, right? But they've been really struggling to define Joe Biden and villainize him. And right. So instead, they've turned to Kamala. And yeah, it makes sense. Immigration, that riles up their base, that really excites them. But you also have to look at who are the other politicians that they tend to demonize. It's Speaker Pelosi, AOC, Maxine Waters. It's women, and it's women of color.
Right, yeah. And to that point, look, this is what happened on Fox News this week, which will surprise no one.
This is what happens when you choose your vice president based on gender and skin color rather than actual talent and expertise.
Oh,
We're seeing that disaster unfold right now.
That's so mean.
Oh, it's mean.
Was attorney
it's actually
general,
true.
To be fair, Geraldo just jumped in and said that's mean. It's also racist and sexist. But this is the kind of attack that she's facing. At the same time, they know this is coming. Should she not have something on her agenda that where she can get a win out of this at the end of the day?
Well, I think pretty much anything a vice president's going to be tasked with is going to be difficult. I think that comes with the territory. I do think, as Melanie indicated, they're targeting her in part because she's a black woman. And race is the number one issue for Republicans right now. This is a white party that's rallying white, aggrieved white Americans who feel like they're losing control of their country. And so that's why we talk about critical race theory all the time on Fox News. I do think that some of the criticism that Harris got was misplaced. The criticism for saying do not come, that's exactly what Joe Biden's been saying ever since the administration started.
Position. Yeah.
It's completely expected. But as Olivier indicated, this was a completely anticipated question, and the obvious discomfiture she had over getting asked it, the nervous laughter, that's kind of a tick that she has that I think she's going to have to get over and display more command and confidence as she looks to the future.
Especially because, as we've been discussing, she will be perhaps the number one target for this administration. Republicans basically preparing for her to be Joe Biden's successor. So that is, we know that that's coming, and it seems like her team probably should get prepared for that. But that's in Inside. That's it for Inside Politics Sunday. Join us back here every Sunday at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and the weekday show as well at noon Eastern Time. Up next, State of the Union with Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. Dana's guests include House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Thank you again for sharing your Sunday morning with us. Have a great rest of your day.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.